Good morning.
Morning.
In our final class, we will discuss the renormalization of phi cube theory. So the theory we're interested in studying is Klein-Gordon theory. With a new interaction term. Which is g over 3 factorial phi cubed. Now, we spent the last few lectures developing perturbation theory where we assumed we could just take a free theory and add a new term. We saw earlier in the course that we're not really justified in doing that. In particular, when we were discussing the LSZ reduction formula, we made two assumptions that are relevant here. We made other assumptions as well, but the ones that are relevant are that we assume that the vacuum expectation value of the field vanished. And we also assumed that the form factor was the same as in the free theory. And these two things told us we have to shift and rescale. We have to shift and rescale by a particular amount to make these conditions hold. And so we'll see what that implies on our theory. But we do the shifting and rescaling. That tells us that we should do perturbation theory not with this Lagrangian, but rather with a shifted and rescaled Lagrangian. So I shift and rescale and rename some parameters. What I'm left with is a Lagrangian that looks like this. So I get these extra factors of z. Multiplying each of the original terms. And I also get a new term, a linear term from the shift. There's also a constant term which doesn't affect the dynamics, so we'll ignore that one. So our goal today is to understand how to do perturbation theory using this Lagrangian, taking into the fact that we need to renormalize, and we can't just take our free Lagrangian and add a new term. It's not consistent with what we did earlier. OK. Nevertheless, we can break this term up into a free part plus some new part. The new part is not just this term, but we can still break our Lagrangian up into a free part plus an interaction part. Our free part is just the Klein-Gordon Lagrangian. And now our interaction part has two terms. The part we wanted, which is minus g over 3 factorial phi cubed, and some new terms that we were forced to add. And I'll call those extra terms counter terms. And that's everything else we need to add to make the terms we wanted match up with what we were forced to have. And so we have a half z phi minus 1 phi squared, a half zm minus 1 m squared phi squared. And third, zg minus 1. my cubed, and this linear term. So our theory, original theory that we started out with, had two parameters. Which were physical parameters. We expected we could be able to measure the mass and the strength of the coupling. They're not quite, because we have to do this, but we naively expected those to be physical. Now, in this new Lagrangian, we're forced to use, we have extra parameters. So ZM and M are not really independent, and the same with ZG and G. So we can think about this as being four parameters. Two physical, and two related to the choice of normalization. And our goal today is going to be to try to determine, at least in principle, how we would compute those quantities. And we'll see what that will have some important and physical implications. In particular, we're going to have to think carefully about both what we mean by the physical mass and what we mean by the physical coupling. So these parameters here are not the physical parameters. It's naively what you'd expect, but they're not exactly the physical parameters. Okay. And we're going to work perturbatively. So very few quantum field theories can be solved exactly. Klein-Gordon is one of them. If we add a perturbation, in general, we can't solve it exactly. So we'll work perturbatively. And what do we expect? And these expectations we will be able to show are correct based on the calculations we'll do. We expect the ZIs. By ZI, I mean either Z phi, ZM, or ZG. These should all be 1. We go back to the Klein-Gordon theory by setting G equal to 0. All those terms should go away. Plus, if we're computing this perturbatively in G, it'd be plus some order G terms. That's the expectation. We'll find, in fact, that one of these, the leading order correction, vanishes in the second order. And the expectation for Y is that, and similarly, is that this term should be gone when G goes to 0. So it's 0 plus some order G correction. And if we want to do perturbation theory correctly, we can't use this Lagrangian. We need to use this Lagrangian, which means that we have more vertices. So we have, in addition to the three point vertex, we have extra vertices. We have a 1-point vertex, which is weird. Vertices with two lines that end on them from both of these terms. That's, again, weird. That's not something we've encountered so far. Before, when we were adding new terms, there's always three or more fields. So we have these new terms, and two of them are quite weird. Okay, so let's write down the Feynman rules. So first, we have the three-point vertex. And in position space, for the endpoint function, the vertex rule for this It's just given by this term. So it's this is not a large modification for what we've seen before. We instead of having a minus I g, we have a minus I zg times g times the integral of x. So this is a small change. But before, when we were doing perturbation theory, this is the only term we considered without the zg. And now we have two extra terms. We have the term where a single line ends, which I'll indicate by an x to indicate that this is a vertex, not an external point. The Feynman rule for this is the point x, is minus I y integral d4x. We also have vertices with two lines ending from both of these two terms. And I left off some derivatives. This should be derivative. This term involves derivatives, so it's easier to express in momentum space. We could express it in position space. It would be an ugly expression. We won't. When we use it, we'll use it in momentum space. So I'll just write down the momentum space rule for that vertex. So we also have, and this x indicates that this is an interaction vertex. And here, if we're in momentum space, the rule is, I'll get the signs right. I p squared z phi minus 1 minus I z m minus 1 m squared. Okay. So that's the first change we see. So if we want to do perturbation theory, we don't just have a single vertex, we have three. OK. Now, our goal is to do perturbation theory. So there are two issues we need to address. One is we need to make sure that we impose these conditions. So we can use the LSID reduction formula. So first, let's check that. And then the other issue is, what exactly are our physical parameters? Which combination of these parameters is what we can measure? So those are the two questions we want to address today. Yes, Hojun?
I have a question about the last line. Why do we have I in the equation?
This line?
Yes.
The I comes from. So we're going to go to the interaction picture, take our correlation function in the Heisenberg picture, go to the interaction picture. We have the exponential of I times the integral d4x of the interaction Lagrangian. That's where the I comes from.
So badly splitting it into position space and momentum space shouldn't be maybe do everything in momentum space.
We should, and we will. So I'm first going to do a calculation in position space that doesn't involve this one. And then I'm going to do a calculation in momentum space that involves all of them. These ones are easy to do in either way. Okay. Okay, so.
Dan?
Yes, yeah?
Why is it not zg minus 1, z phi minus 1, and stuff like that?
So here, I've combined two terms. I've written this just as a single vertex, so I've grouped together both this term and this term.
Okay.
I didn't have to do that. I could write them as two separate terms, and you sometimes see that done. So first we want to check what, first we'll check what constraints these conditions put on our parameters. And let's start with the first one, Bev. Okay. This is our constraint. We assume this when we derive the LSI reduction formula. Let's see what constraints that puts on our parameters. And if we want to write this in terms of Feynman diagrams, well, so this is also time ordered. We just have one thing, it's already in time ordered. So we can use the Feynman rules for the correlation functions to compute this. And there's no diagrams I can draw with no vertices. So I need to have at least one vertex. And one such diagram I can draw. Uses this vertex. I can also draw a diagram with this vertex. And both of these diagrams are order G. So this diagram is order G because ZG is 1 plus something of order G. This diagram is order G because Y is order G to start with. You know, it's 0 at order G to the 0. And these are the only two diagrams I could draw at order G. I want to have draw an extra diagram, I'll need at least two vertices. And that every time we add a vertex, we add a contribution that's at least order G. Again, Z phi minus 1, ZM minus 1 are order G as well. So plus order G squared. OK. So let's compute these. So this first diagram has a propagator from x to y. It has one vertex, which is associated with a factor of minus I y integral d4y. And that's it. Our next diagram has two propagators, delta xy, delta yy, one vertex, and anything else?
Symmetry.
Symmetry factor, yes. What's a symmetry factor?
Two.
Two. Thanks, Marco. Yes. So this is our expression. Plus higher order terms. Okay. We can simplify this. And the way we can simplify this is we can note that delta yy is actually independent of y. The Feynman propagator is just a function of the difference between the two space-time points. So we can write this first term as, we'll leave alone. Let me write it differently. So after we pull out the delta yy, we had two terms that both involve integral d4 y of delta xy. So it's something times integral d4 y delta xy. What we have here is minus iy from the first term, and the next term is minus ig over 2 delta timing propagator at zero, or at the same point. So zero, zero. Here I also use that ZG is one plus order G. And so this is an equation we can solve for y. We want this to be 0, and that gives us a constraint on y. So we see that y is minus g over 2 times Feynman propagator evaluated at the same point. So this gives us a formal expression for y. It ends up being divergent. This diverges. So one approach we could take to deal with this problem is introduce a regulator, regulate this, and compute quantities. But as we'll see in just a minute, there's another approach we could take, which is just to note that if we set y to have this value, what this is saying is that the sum of all diagrams with one external point is equal to 0. But this factorizes. If we attach this to some other part of the diagram, this factorization would still work. So the fact that this sum of all diagrams with one external point is 0 also tells us that the sum of all diagrams attached by one point to the rest equals 0. So we just don't need to compute those. We make this observation. What this is saying is that if I look at a diagram like this, this diagram plus this diagram should be equal to 0. This is just diagrams we considered, but attached to something else. If I wanted to write down the expressions for these, I just write down what I wrote times the expression for the rest of the diagram. So this cancellation works, regardless of whether they're attached to something else or not. So this constraint is easy to impose in practice, which just means we don't need to consider diagrams that are attached by only one point to the rest. So individually, these diagrams both diverge, but their sum is 0.
This only holds on attaching to vacuum of vacuum diagrams, or?
These diagrams would contribute to the two-point correlation function. So these are not vacuum diagrams.
But I'm like attaching to a kind of, it's like this, and then I'm attaching it to a vacuum gas.
That's right, yes. You have, you're looking at the sum of all diagrams that are something, and then attached by a point, and this is all connected. And this is anything. And this is a single line. So that's what our first condition imposes on the constants in our theory. Let's look at the next. Assumption we made. It's about the form factor. So this would be a weird quantity to compute using the techniques we've developed. It's half in momentum space and half in position space. We could develop new Feynman rules to look at this, but it's going to turn out to be much easier to just work entirely in momentum space. And so the quantity we'll consider is the momentum space two-point function. And we'll define it by taking a Fourier transform of the position space two-point function. So we'll do Fourier transform with respect to both of the arguments, d for x and d for x prime of this correlation function, position space. And we expect, based on general principles, that this should be 0 unless momentum is conserved. So this should be 2 pi to the 4th, delta to the 4th, e plus e prime, times something else, which I'll call g2 of p. So this g2 of p is the momentum space two-point function with a delta pulled out. Okay. And so this is what we'll examine next. And we're going to do it two ways. And comparing those ways will give us both constraints on some of these parameters, as well as a better understanding of what we mean by our physical parameters, M in particular for this case. And the first result I'd like to discuss is known as the Chalin-Lemon spectral representation. And this is an exact result in quantum field theory. Exact results in quantum field theory are rare. They're generally quite important. They give us an exact handle on the theory. To derive the Chalin-Lemon spectral representation, we'll need to make a few assumptions. I won't go through a full derivation. I just want to sketch the key ideas. And the assumptions we'll make are, first, we will assume that the vacuum expectation value of the field is 0. Second, we'll assume that the form factor is e to the ikx. And third, we'll assume that there are no bound states. So some of these assumptions should look familiar to you. Yes, I hope so. The first two are things we assumed in deriving the LSZ reduction formula. This last one can be relaxed. So we'll assume this for now, and it makes the derivation easier, but we can relax this. Okay. And the first observation we'll make in sketching a derivation of the LSED reduction formula is that we can write the identity operator as a sum of three types of terms. So any state in our Hilbert space is a superposition of some states with a definite number of particles. So we can write the identity operator as a projection onto the ground state. Plus a projection operator onto the one particle states. Plus a projection operator onto the multiparticle states. I could write these together, but each of these terms will play a different role in the Lehmann, Chalin-Lehmann spectral representation. So I'm going to write the projection operator over multiparticle states as an integral over the total three momentum. As well as a sum and integral over some other parameters. Specify which multiparticle state it is. There's generally many parameters I need to specify. Specify the total momentum, the relative momentum, possibly other parameters like the particle type or spin or what were we dealing with spinless particles here? But in general, there would be many other parameters here, could be charge. And so a multiparticle state I'll denote by K sigma. Okay. So this is our starting point. For any interacting theory, if we can talk about particles, we can write the identity operator in this way. And the basic idea behind the Chalin-Lehmann spectral representation is just to insert this identity operator into the two-point function. So if we write omega t 5x, 5y, omega, and we insert the one here, we can write this as, let's assume x naught is greater than y naught for now. Sum of three terms. So the first term is omega 5x omega omega 5y omega. Then we have another term with the one particle states. That's omega 5x k at the integral d3k. K I have y, omega, and plus a similar term for the multi-particle states. So far, I've just plugged the identity in here. Now we can make a number of simplifications. Does anyone see a simplification we can make to any of these terms? Yes. And what assumption can we use here?
For the second equation, we have this k phi omega.
That's right. Yes. So we know, we assume what the form factor is, so we can replace this with the form factor. This will be equal to, so that's exactly what we can do for the second term. What is there anything we can say about the first term?
It's zero.
That's right, yes. So this term is zero by assumption. And this is, the second term is we just have the form factor and the Hermitian conjugate of the form factor. So that gives us an e to the I k x minus y. Then we have this plus the other term, which we can't really simplify. This term may look familiar to you. Does anyone recognize this? Hey, Jim. It's related to a delta function. It's not. So if we didn't have this ek and this was an integral d4k, it would be a delta function.
Yes.
Anyone recognize this term? We've seen this before.
It's a Green's function.
Green's function, yes, yes. It's Green's function. And in particular, if we combine this with the other term, we get exactly the Feynman propagator. So this is part of the Feynman propagator. The next thing we did to turn this into the Feynman propagator was to rewrite this integral as an integral d4k over 2 pi to the fourth 2 pi delta of k squared minus m squared. And we can do that next step here as well. But here, you have not made any assumptions about the Lagrangian. If we went to relate this expression for the Lorentz invariant measure to this one, we're using the relativistic dispersion relation, e squared equals k squared plus m squared. So this m here is the physical mass. We can also use this relation in the multiparticle sector as well. And that will tell us that this other term will be 0. In a region of parameter space. So in particular, with our assumption about the spectrum of bound states, so if there's no bound states, that tells us that the invariant mass squared of the multiparticle states has to be greater than or equal to the mass of a two-particle state. So if we write this in terms of a four-dimensional integral, this will be integral d4k for 2 pi to the fourth I over p squared minus m physical squared plus I epsilon. So this is the term we'll get from the when we insert the one particle part of the identity. And then we'll have some plus something else. But that something else will be 0 unless the mass is greater than 4m. So we can write this as an integral over some parameter on d rho of something. Let me try to use the same notation. Did I call it rho? I think I called it s. The integral of something, some function, unknown function rho of s over k squared minus s plus I epsilon, where s goes from 4m squared to infinity. So I've just used, we don't know anything yet about what this is, but we just know it. This term, in particular, doesn't have a pole near k squared equals m physical squared. Or if we look at the Fourier transform of this, g2 of p, that's a simpler expression. It's I over k squared minus m physical squared plus I epsilon plus this other term. OK, so what does this mean? This means that the exact two-point function has a pole at the physical mass. The two-point function in the interacting theory pole at k squared equals m physical squared. It also tells us about the residue of that pole. Residue is just I. And the fact that it's an interacting theory instead of a free theory, well, it means two things. It means that the exact propagator is no longer just this term. We have this extra term, which we can't say much about. But it also means that the mass here might be different than the mass we started with in Lagrangian. But this gives us a handle, a way we can relate the physical mass, which we can measure, to something we can compute. So we know how to compute Green's functions perturbatively. We know how to take Fourier transforms. So G2OP is something we can compute using perturbation theory. And we can compare that computation to our exact result to get a handle on what the physical mass means. Yes?
Where's the exponent dependence of the first equation?
There should be an exponential, yes. Thank you. Okay. Should be minus. Yeah.
Can you explain more about the condition? I mean, this third assumption that there's no boundary states and how we get to the first line.
Okay, so let's say we're in the center mass frame. So there's no relative momentum. The spectrum will have a state with zero particles, with zero energy, up to some choice. That's arbitrary. But the difference in energy between the ground state and the state with one particle will be m squared. So if you look at the E. So there's a state here. This is the ground state. No particles. In the center of mass frame, if we have one particle, the total energy just has to be E. E equals M. If we have two particles, we could have two particles that are relative to one another. In which case the energy is 2m if there's no interaction energy, no potential energy between the two particles. It could be more than that. We assume there's no bound state, so it can't be less than that. So there's a state here, 2m, but it could be more. So it could be anywhere up here. And so those are the allowed, the lowest possible energies that our system could have in the center mass frame. And if we go to a different frame, that will mean that the spectrum should look something like this. Now, if there are bound states, something could be living in this region. Okay. This is a good place to take a break. So let's resume in 5 minutes.
That's right. And in the center of mass frame, a three vector k is zero.
Yeah, that's right. But if you have an interacting theory, then the Hamiltonian will have the
terms. The Hamiltonian will have other terms, but the relativistic dispersion relation is the definition of the relationship between energy and mass.
if I take the another one for tracking theory and then act it on the surface, it's the other k on the vacuum. Won't I get some other terms of survival fast when you can?
So at a fixed time, the observation operators are the same.
It's like,
time, all of the differences are in the time evolution.
Right.
So,
as the
there are no diagrams I can draw with this one standpoint. So if I wanted to use that diagram, I would just do
You get this stuff?
It's
so random.
So we did the assumptions first.
Yeah,
and then we bound states. The center mass frames, the lowest line states are the vacuum state, the carbon state, the energy atoms.
But even like
particles,
even this manipulation
far away and the
tricky.
I mean, it's like
completeness relation, the first two simplify, and then how do you get rho s k squared times x? You see that second term, the integral of ds, 4m squared to infinity. You just pulled it out of the
sense. Unless you mess up with the concept.
The multiplier.
Steps to go from where we have
like you can
down there to this term.
that's fine.
The other one, only claim I make here is any function can fit here as long as it's zero or when z squared is less than an epsilon. No particular.
Definition
of a bound state is a state with less energy than two particles that are far away.
I'm also trying to like interpret it in quantum mechanics in some way. How we define this bound state.
And then there's a plus
with this hotspot.
It's fine, like going to the central mass frame and putting energy as a function of the system and saying, okay, we don't have any circuit, but it's still becoming super noisy and this is
I mean, you have to also consider the flying or
so it's a non-trivial question.
Differences in like angles of like the momentum.
That's right.
Number of articles.
This is not the exponential out of row. Is that like
so that should be a plus of pi.
So bad. Carefully in this row can be related.
Because then I'm also assuming something about the form factor for the multi-particle states if it's long here.
It's just like, so we separated the garage into
you don't need to make that assumption with the multiple cars.
That's why you have minus one. So it's the same as is that assumption on the formula of the
Okay, so then that y on that
LC. You don't understand milder because minus y.
So
that's
what we're
going to use for y5. That's a minus.
So then
we
do it live. Yeah,
to make that a minus.
Yeah, to cancel out.
Well, like you said, any power otherwise.
I mean, no. It's just that LC and T is just add. That would definitely be. Then I will have like some overlap with like vacuum field and this multi-particle state. So assuming that that's one.
No, that's one.
Oh, I see.
Okay, let's resume. Okay, so we now have an exact result for the two-point function. Let's compute it using perturbation theory and compare our results. Kripal?
So first, on the top, what was your argument regarding hooking those diagrams to zero? So all the diagrams with one external point and all the diagrams attached by one point?
Oh, so what we imposed was that the vacuum expectation value of the field is zero. Vacuum expectation value of the field in terms of Feynman diagrams is the sum of all diagrams with one external point, no vacuum subdiagrams. So we were assuming that. So we assumed this, and we saw that we could factorize. We tried to compute it, we could factorize, and basically the part of the diagram that involved the external point could be pulled out. And the claim I made was that this is general. It didn't matter what was going on this side of the diagram. The factorization would still work if I attached some other I changed x from an external point to an internal point and attached some other things to it. This factorization would still work. So the fact that we assume that this vanishes, plus the factorization implies that the sum of all diagrams attached by only one point to the rest will vanish. So in particular, that would mean that some of these two diagrams are vanished because from this top internal point, this loop up here and this vertex here is attached to the rest of the diagram just by that vertex. That's what I mean there.
So the top line where you say y equals to minus g by 2 delta f0, delta f0 diverges, you mean that then y also diverges?
Y diverges, but it's not something we're measuring. So just like the ground state and energy of for the Casimir effect, we're not directly measuring that. There's no experiment you can do that can let you measure y.
So are we saying that we have two infinite quantities and infinity minus infinity, we are saying it's zero?
It's zero, and to make that statement mathematically precise, we'd need to introduce a regulator. We could do that, but we won't do that here, but we could. Thank you for that. Yes.
One more question. Regarding that second, the multi-particle term, I think the second term, that integration over ds, is the multi-particle term?
This is the multi-particle term, yes.
So rho s is basically the function of all the other momenta labels which we had, like the sigma that you mentioned?
That's right. So this rho s will, it's closely related to this sum over sigma of this amplitude squared, it's almost exactly that. I think there might be some deltas or something.
Yeah, but how did the exponential factor come out? This exponential of minus I k dot x minus y out of those multi-particle terms?
Okay, so that I used the fact that the momentum multi-particle states are in a momentum eigenbasis, so they're can write some momentum operator, which they're eigenstates of, and also that the vacuum state is Poincaré invariant, so it's invariant under translations. It's similar to the argument we did when we were showing that the vacuum expectation value is in fact a constant. We wrote the field operator in terms of space-time translation operators. Do the same argument here to show that you get that exponential factor.
And I also have a question.
Yes.
So are the rest of the labels sigma absorbed into rho?
There, yes. 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 There's interesting things to say about rho, but rho is generally harder to compute, but and might depend on the theory. This term is universal. This term is always the same. This term will show up. This term will tell us about the existence of this term is why we should amputate. I'll have more to say when I connect this to perturbation theory. This term is extremely important. This term is also interesting, but this term is crucial. Yes.
Can the multi-particle states also give a residue I? Because then I wouldn't have really like a way to distinguish them from the two-point function.
They could. There's very little we can say in general about rho, which would affect the residue. But we do know that if there's no bound states, any potential poles or branch cuts would start at s equals 4m squared. So that they're separated, and the lowest lying pole is at m squared. Okay. So we have an exact result. Let's connect that to perturbation theory. So G2 of P, remember, is the Fourier transform of the two-point function. So the same diagrams will contribute to G2 of P as will contribute to the position space two-point function. We just need to take Fourier transform at the end. You're exploring this in your homework. I'm just going to write this diagrammatically, but so the important point for what I'm going to say is that the same diagrams will contribute to Fourier transform. Okay, so if we want to compute this using perturbation theory at zeroth order in our coupling, we just have the free propagator. If we go to higher order, there's lots of diagrams. We could have a diagram like this, or like this. We also have diagrams like this, or like this. And we could go to higher order. And let's do that to try to understand the structure. At higher order, we have a diagram that would look like this, diagram that looks like this, diagram that looks like this. What else do we have? Diagram that looks like that, and possibly more. Do I have? Okay, that's sufficient for what I want to say. So this diagram is order g to the zero. This diagram is order g squared. We know this diagram is at least order g. What we said before. And this diagram is at least order g squared, g squared. These are higher order terms. We start at g to the fourth. These ones are g to the zero, g squared. Now, a few things you may notice about these diagrams. In particular, we can say something about the second line. What can we say about that?
Zero.
Yes. Thank you. So these are zero, not individually, but these sum to zero. So we don't need to consider those. Another thing we may notice when we look at these diagrams is that, well, most of the order g to the fourth diagrams look like copies of the order g squared diagrams stuck together. And in fact, this is a useful observation. We can rewrite g2 in another way. So I can say that this diagram is just a line. These diagrams, this diagram and this diagram, consist of lines connected to the external part plus something else in the middle, which is not a line. But stays connected if I remove any one line. So I call that a 1PI part. And this diagram and this diagram have two lines, some 1PI part, one particle irreducible. And so does this one. Now, these diagrams here are not of this form. They're not just a propagator, one PI part, then a propagator. But they're a rather mild generalization. They're the form 1PI part, 2 1PI parts connected by a third propagator. So this part here is one particle irreducible, so is this part. So if I remove the top line, the part in the blue box remains connected. Same if I remove the bottom line. This two vertex has no lines to remove, so it's one particle irreducible. And we see that maybe computing all these diagrams individually is not the best way to do things. We compute these diagrams. We already have done most of the work in computing these higher order diagrams. And in particular, if we can compute the sum of all 1PI diagrams, at least at some order in perturbation theory, then we can compute the two-point function. And let's call the sum of all these 1PI diagrams minus I times sigma of P squared. So this is sometimes known as the self-energy. With that identification, we can compute G2 of P. G2 of P, this first diagram gives us an I over P squared minus M squared. It's I epsilon. Next diagram has two lines. So we get this squared times the minus I sigma. And so on. This is a geometric series, which you can resum. If we resum it, we get is I over P squared minus M squared minus sigma of P squared. So this is summing the series. So we see that we compute it perturbatively. We find is that the two-point function involves both a mass that shows up in the Lagrangian . This is a perturbative calculation where we're expanding around the free Klein-Gordon theory, which we're specifying by writing a term with a particular mass parameter. Then we have this correction to what we'd expect in the free theory. We have this self-energy term. It's something we could compute using perturbation theory. So at leading order, we just have these two terms, which we could compute. But we know something about this function. We just computed this exactly. So we know there has to be a pull at P squared equals M squared, and it has to have a particular residue. So if we want this function to have the correct pull and residue, that imposes constraints on our theory. In particular, that tells us that sigma of m physical squared should be 0, and correct residue tells us that the derivative of sigma with respect to p squared evaluated at m physical squared should be 0. So these are two more constraints. So we had originally in a naive specification of the theory, we had two physical parameters. Once we shifted and rescaled, renormalized our theory, we have four parameters, two of them which are physical, two are normalization. So we've essentially taken care of, at higher orders they mix, but at lowest order you can distinguish them. So our condition on y, I'll just essentially fix one of these normalizations. These two, this one essentially fixes the other normalization and gives us a relationship between our physical mass and our Lagrangian mass. So sigma, this will depend on the Lagrangian mass. So if we compute this, we compute this diagram, we compute it using the Lagrangian we wrote down. So this gives us the, this connects m physical squared and m Lagrangian squared. Okay, but we're not done yet. We have three conditions and we have four parameters. So we need one more condition.
Yes, ma'am? No, no, I just want to see the fourth one.
Okay, I'll raise it up. Okay. So we need one more condition. And it should involve the coupling. We need to have a way to relate experiments to the way we write down our theory, to the Lagrangian. So in the same way that the Chalin-Lehmann representation gives us a relationship between the physical mass and the mass we write down in the Lagrangian. Sigma is something we can compute. It will depend on the Lagrangian mass, and we know something about its value at the physical mass. So we need something similar for the coupling. And essentially, we need to come up with a definition of what we mean by the coupling. And there's no unique answer to that question. You could demand or define the coupling, define the physical coupling by saying that the amplitude is some particular function of G physical at for given that. Given I and F. You could, that would work. It turned out to be more difficult in practice than you need. Alternatively, you could build on the idea we used before about breaking diagrams down into smaller pieces. Essentially, what we saw for the two-point function is we could build all two-point functions if we just had two ingredients, the free propagator and the 1PI parts of diagrams that are with two connections to the rest. We can generalize that to higher point functions. So if we're looking at a three-point function, we can do something similar. We could write a three-point function as some 1PI part at the middle is connected in three parts to the rest of the diagram. And then on each leg, we basically have a two-point propagator, which is a bunch of 1PI parts. So any information we can get from the three-point function, which we could use to compute scattering amplitude or a decay of one particle to two particles, for example, we could extract from the three-point correlation function, which we could build if we knew the three-point irreducible function, three-point one-particle irreducible functions, and the two-point one particle irreducible functions. So if we know these building blocks, we can construct all the correlation functions we need. And we've already imposed a condition on the 2-point one particle irreducible function. So it turns out the simplest thing to do is put a condition on the three-point one-particle irreducible functions. So we often call this function gamma 3, p1, p2, and p3. So defining the coupling by putting a condition on this building block is equivalent in principle, but easier in practice, to putting a condition on the correlation functions or the scattering amplitudes. So usually what we do is we'd say that gamma 3, p1, p2, p3 is defined to be our coupling at some reference energy scale. Now, there's an arbitrariness here. I could choose any definition I like. So I might, for simplicity, I might choose to impose this condition when the reference energy squareds are all equal to some u squared. But this is arbitrary. And this means there might be several ways to get the same theory. Make a different choice of g and a different choice of mu, I might end up with the same theory in the sense that I could make all the same predictions. We don't expect these to be physically independent parameters. We started off with two physical parameters. Renormalization meant we added two extras that were just not physical, but related to normalization. We already have three conditions. So there should only be, we should only have one, should only be able to impose one condition, not on one parameter. Not, we shouldn't have this x two parameters left. So these can't be independent. So G really should depend on mu. Mu is arbitrary. We'll make stronger and different arguments for why the physical coupling has to depend on the energy scale later in the year. But just counting parameters suggests that, and thinking about how we can connect our theory with the experiment suggests that these can't be independent. So what will happen is if we look at how we, G, the coupling we'd measure as a function of the energy scale at which we measure it, will in general be some curve, not some, won't be a constant. And different theories can live on different lines. But two points on the same curve are the same theory. We'll make more careful arguments about why this is the case in future courses. But we'll see that exactly the same thing happens in the delta prime potential in non-relativistic quantum mechanics. If we ask, what is the strength of the potential? That's not a well-posed question. We need to say, what is the strength of the potential if I'm measuring it with a probe of this energy? That's a well-defined question. And once we ask the right question, we see that we're forced to make the coupling dependent on the energy which we measure it. We'll see that in detail in today's tutorial. But it's the same idea in quantum field theory, and we'll do more careful argument in future courses about why this has to be and what the physical implications are this running of the coupling. So this is the term we use for this energy dependence of the coupling. So couplings can be stronger or weaker depending on the scale at which you measure them. Okay. Georgia.
Then since mu is an arbitrary parameter, can we say mu is some scale? So that
that's right.
You change scale, then you change the coupling parameter based on the scale. The coupling constant.
That's right, yes. So what this is saying is that if I fix the theory, say I'm living on this line here, and I measure the coupling at this energy scale, I'll get this value. Measure the coupling at this other energy scale, I'll get a different value.
Okay, and it can be interpreted as change of the frame based on scale?
Suppose you could think about it, but I think about it as the coupling itself is changing, depending on which energy at which you measure it.
Okay.
So this is, it's observed in particle physics and other contexts. So you may have heard of the fine structure constant, which is related to the strength of the electromagnetic coupling. That constant is the value you measure at very low energies. Try to measure it at higher energies, it changes. And the effect is a few percent. But other couplings can have larger changes depending on the energies you measure in the particular theory. So we'll learn how to compute these curves and how the coupling you measure depends on the energy scale which you measure it in future courses in QFT1 and QFT2 and statistical physics. We'll learn how to compute these curves. But we will compute one such curve in tutorial today. So that's we'll see that this works even in non-relativistic quantum mechanics. And it's the same idea. The math will be much easier today. And the concepts, but it's the same idea we'll see in many courses in the future. Okay, so we've reached the end of quantum theory course. And as you can see, we've only scratched the surface of many of these topics. So we'll come back to a lot of these ideas in future courses. We'll also go in a number of new directions. So in QFT1, you'll learn how to deal with particles of spin, generalizing what we saw here, where we had particles with no spin. We briefly discussed symmetries. That's an idea that will be built upon. You'll discuss how to deal with particles, in particular with local symmetries, in both the QFT1 and QFT2 courses. Well, much more to say about path and functional integral in QFT2. We'll look at theories with extra symmetries, like conformal symmetries in the QFT3 course. Also anomalies and effects that can break those symmetries, to quantum effects that can break those symmetries. And in many future courses, you'll see applications of what we learned here to cosmology, to quantum matter, and other topics. So thank you. I've enjoyed all your questions and comments. And thank you.